and their winter plans. They flew a couple of plane loads of press in from Anchorage and other areas, and they were a little late getting in because of the weather, but they have just arrived here in the room and are scrambling madly to get lights and cameras up all over the place. It was, you know, it was kind of quiet before they showed up, but now it's a mad scramble as everybody looks for outlets and places to put their equipment. They have handed out some information about the winter program. I know of interest to local residents in Valdez. They say that spill cleanup operation coordinators will be in Valdez until about November 1st. We'll have two boats home ported in Valdez, one with skimming capability, one additional boat until November 1st. Local call-up personnel to be identified for anticipated cleanup response. Back here on buildings, what did it say? See if I can find that place. Interesting. Well, for one thing, it said multiple points of debarkation will be utilized to minimize community disruption while maximizing time available for shoreline treatment activities. And meetings, four steering committee meetings in Anchorage, three interagency shoreline cleanup committee meetings in Anchorage, two science and research and development meetings in Anchorage. And there's a place in here, someplace I saw about housing. This is a big book. It must have about 35 pages in it. We have a map of where they're going to store things in Anchorage. Here it is, here on the transition to the winter plan. This is the full plan that they have sent to Rear Admiral Cengolini, and it says there are two factors that have significant influence on our ability to complete shoreline treatment programs. These are bad weather and not receiving approval to use clicks at 9580. Well, I think we're about ready. I'll turn the microphone over to Exxon.
Looks good. Well, good morning and welcome to the Exxon Command Center in Valdez. Our purpose today is to give you an update on the oil spill cleanup and to introduce our Alaska winter program and describe to you how we're going to transition to that program. The presentation will be made by our general manager, Otto Harrison, and Otto will start off with 2 or 3 minutes of overview, and we would like to request that during that time you hold your questions, but then you'll go into a detailed description of the three parts of the presentation, utilizing the charts that you see up here. And we would recommend that you do ask your questions as he goes through those portions of it so that you can understand what he's saying as he goes through. So now, for those of you who haven't met Otto, this is Otto Harrison, General Manager of Valdez Operations.
Thank you, Don. Let me, just to start off, let me give you a safety briefing. For those of you who have not been in this building or conference room before, should there be a problem, we don't anticipate any, but should there be a problem, you would exit through the door that's behind you, the black door. There's a stairway down to your right. If that's not available for you, you should go all the way to the rear and exit out to the left. If there is a need to exit, be careful. There are tripods around and there is cable on the floor that you need to be very careful about. I would also point out that we have Bill Rainey over here on my right against the wall, who is our operations manager. And there are some of the questions that it may be more appropriate for Bill to answer. We have Monique Taylor here with our community liaison program. We have two of our technical experts back here in Bob Mastracchio, John Prince, and one of our key planning guys, Steve Tyson, that's in here. So we think we can between us cover the issues that may be of interest. First, let me give you an outline of what we'll be talking about today. The package that we have presented to you, the program that I will be parts. It reviews the status as of August 15, 1989, and particularly reviews that status relative to the May 24th plan that was approved by the U.S. Coast Guard. So we'll look at the status items, and we'll describe within that the progress that we think we'll be making before the onset of a severe winter season. In that status, one of our real highlights and the thing that I'll start talking about is our safety program, which we're extremely pleased with, and we'll talk about some of the other key factors that are important in achieving that program. The second part of the package that you have, and I will be reviewing, is our 1989 Alaska Winter Program. And that winter program has a number of elements. It has two main elements that we will focus on. One of those is the operating and contingency plan, and we'll describe the details of what are in that plan. And the second of that, which is very important, is the science program. And the science program, which is quite extensive, is one that allows us to evaluate, collect, and evaluate the information that will give us a clear understanding of what the shorelines and water are like next spring. The third part that I'll talk about is the transition that carries us from our current high level of activity into the winter program. And we've had an extensive team working on that. We've had a group in that's been working for about 6 weeks on that. Some of you have been asking for this plan before because it's been well known that we had a team in working on it. They have completed that work. It is quite detailed work. And I'll give you an idea of how that fits into the overall program. It primarily is a safety-driven program, and I'll point out those safety features to you and point out how we have incorporated those into the program so that we're able to execute from here to the winter and through the winter in a way that's safe to all the people that are involved in the workforce, as well as providing the information and contingency response capability that we need through that period of time. Okay, with that overview now, we'll start off, and the first thing that I want to talk about is our safety program. And this is our safety performance as of August of 15. And what you see here is our results. These are measured in incidents per million man hours, and that's just a standard industry OSHA type reference for measuring quality of a safety record. And what you see is that, and these are individual month points, is that these have declined each month since we've started. And to give you a reference, just because there's a scale there and you don't have a reference, this is the 1987 data for heavy construction industry, and this is the 1987 data for non-residential construction. So as you can see, our record relative to those indices is relatively good, has been improving. And that's the result of what I would call three factors. The first is an extremely conscientious Alaskan workforce. And I just can't ever say enough about the quality of that Alaskan workforce and the work ethic that they have brought to the job. It's been outstanding, and you see those kind of results here. The second is a diligent set of supervisors who have executed a very sound and meaningful safety and training program. And the third of those is the cooperation of key groups, and particularly I would comment on the Alaska State Department of Labor, and they've been very cooperative and constructive through this exercise. Now I want to move over and talk about how have we done, and again this is status, relative to the plan. Now, starting on this chart right here, let me move over and talk about people first. Let me start from this side. This is shoreline or people on the beach, and that's a term that was used in our May 24th plan. And this scale over here shows you people on the beach. So what you're seeing is there are somewhere over 3,000 people on the beach. All the bottom numbers show you total people employed, and that's a little over 10,000 total people employed. This part of the bar shows people that are in Prince William Sound. This part shows they're in Gulf of Alaska. This dark line right here represents the May 24th plan. So we have more people on the shoreline
on the beach cleanup than were in the May 24th plan. And with our over 10,000 people, that again is substantially more people than we described that we would be handling in that plan. Now, with our equipment, some of our key equipment are landing craft, which you've heard us talk about before. You can see that this is the May 24th plan on landing craft. This scale right there, that's 50. That was what was in the plan. We have exceeded that number. This little bump up at the end on landing craft is due to a couple of interesting things. One of them we call Batmobiles. That's the bioremediation treatment landing craft that we have that we're utilizing. And the other are some landing craft that we're using in the Gulf of Alaska. So that's caused an added buildup. Again, exceeding the plan. Maxi barges, and this actually includes both what we call a maxi barge and an omni barge. They're the warm water washing barges. We forecasted we would have 20 of those in the plant. Actually, you can see that we reached about 26 of those. They have been very effective, efficient work units for us. Cold water pumping capacity, significant amount of cold water pumping capacity. That's over 120,000 gallons per minute that we're talking about, 1,000 gallons per minute. So it's a large volume. Warm water pumping capacity, significantly above what the planned forecast was. Most of y'all know the story of that due to the fact that we found some PVI heaters. This is a small company in Fort Worth that was able to make a very efficient heater. We were able to put heaters on these barges that were much higher capacity and more efficient than what we originally thought we would be able to utilize when we developed the May 24th plan. So, in all of those key factors as well as people, the status is right now that we have mobilized in general faster than the plan and at a higher level than the plan. Now what we're going to look at here in this next set of charts is what does that mean in terms of shoreline progress. And everybody's got to have a way of keeping score. No ways of keeping score perfect, but this is one that I think we can generally talk about. This shows our shoreline progress in miles on this scale, with the dark area being Prince William Sound, the lighter area being Gulf of Alaska. That includes Seward, Homer, Kodiak, which are other transport areas for us. The bar charts that are shown on here are the number that we have in here, which was 915 miles. As of August 15th, we've actually since then added about another 10 or 11 miles to it, and it's 926 miles at the moment. Now, the symbols on the side, let me just tell you what these are, the little diamonds. At the time we did the May 24th plan, and in the discussions around getting approval for that, what we thought was the total work to be done was about 730 miles, of which about 209 of that was inside of Prince William Sound. Since that time, a lot has gone on. One of those things being very detailed mapping of the Prince William Sound area is a little sidelight. Most of you are aware the Prince William Sound area was not remapped since the 1964 earthquake. And so consequently, the shoreline maps that we had were not the real shoreline that's out there, because part of the sound dropped some feet, part of the sound raised as much as 30 feet, which significantly alters shoreline. So we remapped that, and in remapping and then in going out with scientific teams, and this is biologists, archaeologists, oil measurement experts, that number came up to 345. We also have about 732 in the Gulf of Alaska areas, bringing up to what we think the total now is about 1,077 that we want to get done through this treatment cycle. Now, let's look at those first. You can look at them in just a little more detail. This is Prince William Sound only. This is the same data that's on the bottom of this chart, just a different scale, shows the same 345 miles. That we're talking about right here, and you can see the level of progress that's been going on in Prince William Sound itself. If you look at the Gulf of Alaska, slightly different scale. Now we're talking about things that are in the hundreds, more hundreds of miles, so we're talking about things that are beginning to approach this level right here. We're going to 732 miles, recall, that we want to get done. Those miles, by the way, when we tell you miles, we only count miles the first time we treat them. You'll also hear us talking about retreatment once in a while. If we retreat a shoreline, we don't count that again. And there is a certain amount of retreatment that's involved in a number of areas. So we only count miles the first time around. The work program obviously includes some retreatment. Now let's look at this another way. Now I'm going to show you another kind of graph and another bit of data. This is Prince William Sound treatment schedule. And there are two things you need to know off the bars on top. The first of these are is that the dark bars are firm work schedules. That's work schedules have been laid out, they've been reviewed with the various committees that we deal with and the Coast Guard. And in here it's laid out by task forces. And you have this chart in your handout. You'll also notice there's a lighter colored section. That lighter colored section for each task force is entitled retreatment if needed. The defined work that we know about under the weather conditions that we have assumed, this, that's the work that you need to do. And where we have this, this says this is keeping that equipment in as long as safety allows to do retreatment is required. So you basically see for each group we have some retreatment time. And if you look at this, this is the invert of the curve we were just looking at. This is plotted on miles remaining to be treated. Slightly different graph. It starts at 345 for Prince William Sound. And then as you treat miles, they come off. So basically what you're seeing here, we started with this much heavy, and it's down to this level, and that's what's left. Started with this much moderate, this is what's left. Started with this much light. So you can see the progress that's come here. This is just a result of utilizing this chart. Do I need the microphone?
Yes, for the radio.
Oh, okay. Y'all excuse me here. Do I need this one?
Yes.
See if I can do that without falling over myself. Is that better?
I also want to tell people you can't ask questions and it goes a long way. I don't want to encourage you to play.
Okay. So what this gives you is a feel for the work for the task force, the retreatment capability that we have in it, how Prince William Sound treatment progress looks, taking into consideration the various levels of oil impact that occurred on the beaches. Actually, that shows there's 80 miles left to do in Prince William Sound. When you bring it up to date, to today's data, that's about 75 miles. There are about 75 miles left to be treated in the Prince William Sound. If you take this same sort of data for the Gulf of Alaska, and here we've broken it into what we call the Homer Task Force, Kodiak Task Force, and Seward Task Force. And if you really need more detail, they get more complicated because within the Kodiak Task Force, there are 19 teams. So those are broken into units that are work units. We've again shown the firm work programs that are laid out for each of those task forces. One difference here, in Kodiak, that work program happens to include about 20 miles of scheduled retreatment that we know about, and there is some, has been some re-oiling in Kodiak. And then for all of these teams, we show the potential time that's available for retreatment. Again, if you look at this chart, it starts at the 732 miles. It tends to decline as you get treatment done, so you can get a feel for the treatment progress that's occurring within the Gulf of Alaska. That brings you up to date on the state of our progress, our status as of the 15th. It tells you where we stand in key elements relative to the approved May 24th plan. And it gives you an idea of what our going forward work program is. Now what I propose to do now is move away from that status topic and move over now and talk specifically about the 1989-90 Alaska Winter Program.
Harrison?
Yes, sir.
Subject to the corrective which was just approved by the federal committees, you mentioned in the letter here that the absence of the death factor to be able to complete the work on charts here, it looks like
glad you reminded me of that. I forgot to mention that. There are two things that can keep us from getting this work completed as per that schedule. And one of those is weather. What we've assumed is average weather conditions, and that's not different from prior plans we've turned out. And we know those can be considerably different because we had 50% weather downtime in the month of April. So weather is a factor.
A second factor in that is approval of corrects at 9580, particularly on those heavily oiled beaches. And in these are ones that are weather sensitive because they tend to be open. And the beaches that we're talking about are Point Helen, Latouche, Smith Island, Snug Harbor. These happen to be shoreline areas that are open to the weather. So they get a double dip on that. So we're subject to weather. What the corrects it allows us to do on those beaches, and you're probably aware, we made another proposal to the committee last night. So what that allows us to do on those beaches is to do them faster and do them with less environmental damage. And that tends to get you out of that weather window. And these are the most weather subject areas that we're going to be treating as we wind out this program. So yes, we can say, I should have mentioned those two vulnerabilities. We have those two vulnerabilities. We don't know what the weather is going to be. We don't have approval for corrects at 9580. Yet if we get approval for 9580, it will allow us to mitigate some of the possible downside that we might get out of weather. It will also be a better environmental answer.
When would you need that okay?
Yesterday.
So I'm just wondering,
it's not time to drop it. We are not at Point Helen right now. We are working in Snug Harbor. There's a lot of work to do on Smith Island. Those areas that we're looking at, we need to, those are the areas we're going to right now. They are the remaining heavy oil areas to treat, and we ought to be there. I'm worried about defense. I'm only worried about doing it. My objective is to get it done safely and in an environmentally sound manner. Yes, sir. Our reapplication depended on a number of factors, of which that was one. But let me tell you, that did not surprise our scientists, and let me give you a little bit of a reason why. One of the things that probably happens with this is we probably change the wettability. I don't want to get off in too much technical jargon, but the tendency of those rocks to hold oil on them. I don't know that we have reduced the tendency of that area to go through the phenomena of what we call re-oiling, but I do think we've reduced the phenomena for that to stick on the rock somewhat. And I think that results in a cleaner beach, which is what our objective is. The fact is you can stand on those beaches today, those shorelines today, that have been treated by Corexit on Smith Island. And we had Commissioner Kelso out there this week looking at that. And they are cleaner. They are visibly cleaner than the beach next to them, which has been washed with hot water. And that's what's on the video. That's not an assertion. That's a fact.
Okay. Initially, like maybe the decision was
I'm not sure about all the communication. I do think the early information was incomplete. I think we have a more complete suite of information. We have a better analysis on the cleaning efficiency, which shows it's two times or much better in terms of efficiency. Our operations personnel that are involved, directly involved, also verify that. But let me assure you something. I don't want to blow money out there. And I don't want to blow effort. And I don't want to do anything on that shoreline that doesn't do a better job that's environmentally safe. That's what we're on about. And we wouldn't be proposing that under any other basis And I think if you look at the data, and we're willing to show any of you the data, you will find the data very strong, compelling. Okay. I want to move now and talk back where we're talking about our 1989-90 winter program. And I'm going to focus on two main features in that winter program. I'm going to focus on the operations and contingency plan and the science program. Now, if you will, in looking at this chart right here, let's focus here on what's in the center on that chart. And what's in the center is equipment that we're going to have available here in Alaska for performing the functions that we're going to be describing here. We're going to have two turbo-powered seaplanes. We're going to have four twin-engine helicopters. We're going to have four boats that are 150 foot or greater. And we'll also have a twin-engine turbo-powered fixed-wing land-based aircraft supporting that effort. Now, what that does, that allows us to have facilities that are available to provide contingency response, and these will also provide some level of support to our scientific program, which I'll be talking about in just a minute. In addition to this equipment, we will have up through November the 1st, we will have an additional twin-engine aircraft, an Otter, here in Valdez, and we'll have an additional 150-foot boat. Two of these boats will be based in Valdez, and two will be based between Homer and Kodiak, depending on what the program needs at that particular time. Now, these will be supported by a couple of things. Let me just point out what these are. That shows call-up of experienced personnel. Fortunately, at this time, we have a large number of experienced cleanup personnel in most communities. So through our contractor, we'll have a call-up list that we can have if there is an emergency that we need to respond to, that we can get out either onto the planes or helicopters or boats to respond as appropriate. And those will be lists that will be available in Valdez, Cordova, Seward, Homer, Kodiak, places where we have people that have been in this workforce. Second is we propose to have or make arrangements to have village and city monitoring and some response capability. Those arrangements have not been made, but we can clearly tell you what the objectives of those arrangements are. Our objective is to have local knowledge and input, understanding what's happening during the wintertime. So one of the things we're trying to arrange with our scientists preparing the right kind of report is to report on the condition of the shorelines, to provide tarball sampling, so that we pick up and sample tarballs if and where they occur, and that we get that information back in on a regular basis. In addition, we would like to make arrangements, and now looking at Kodiak, which has six native villages on it, as well as the city of Kodiak, with those communities so that they would be able to pick up tarballs, if needed, under safe conditions, under safe weather conditions. Those arrangements are not made. Those are what we intend to achieve out of the program, and we'll be making those arrangements where possible over the next several weeks. We will also have materials and boom at strategic locations. And what we're going to do is have boom available for use for emergency response for impacts from this spill at strategic locations in the Sound and in the Gulf of Alaska. We're going to have an Anchorage operations office, which has repair and warehousing facilities. The Anchorage operations office is for a couple of reasons. One is during the winter time, as we need to access various locations through this operation, the weather conditions are for flying or better out of Anchorage. Second is for warehousing capability, and I'll show you a plot plan on our warehousing capability in just a moment. We needed a large amount of indoor warehousing capability, and the only place that it was practical to do that was within Anchorage. Just was not available in the other cities that we looked at. We've had, for example, we've had more boom in the water than anybody in the world's ever had in the water, and we've had it for longer. And we want to look at, measure, repair, understand, and report on what happened to that boom. And to do that, we just got to get it into the right kind of facility. that we can repair and maintain that equipment during the wintertime. Operating capability, all of the elements that are in this organization will be in that organization. I'll be there. Our key people will be there in Anchorage through the wintertime. So we will maintain an operating office. Not shown here, we'll have six community liaison offices, seven claim offices that are around. Those will all be available. We will maintain the office space that's here in Valdez. We will maintain housing facilities that are here. We'll put the Bird and Otter Center that are in Seward into cold storage, if you will, for the winter. And so all of those things are going to remain as part of our contingency capability. If you will, put it. Yes, ma'am.
I noticed that two of the boats were going to be stationed in Valdez. Are any of the aircraft stationed in Valdez?
We're initially talking about two of the helicopters working out of Valdez, but we do have a little bit of a problem. As you know, helicopters are susceptible to icing conditions, and there's probably a time during the winter that we may have to base those for a while out of Cordova, or we may have to base them out of Anchorage. That'll be an operational decision. How do we function with those helicopters in a way that is safe to operate? And what you've got to watch for those are icing conditions.
Have you gotten a contractor as far as the aircraft goes?
No, we're in discussions. We have not finalized that.
And as far as the village and city monitoring response arrangements, how would you fund that? I mean, would you give a certain amount of money to the city and then they would operate out of that, or how would that work?
If you don't mind, I'd rather not answer that. What we need to do is we need to make arrangements. In some cases, it may be possible to do it directly with the city. In some cases, it may be more appropriate to do it with a private contractor. I think each city and village will be unique. We're not asking for the same level of response from each one of them, because it should be peculiar to their location, and we just haven't made those arrangements. We really need their local input and knowledge in that exercise, and we want to get out and talk to them about the best way to formulate that.
When's
the what?
Glad
you asked that. Why don't we put up this next chart? Let me show you a couple of things on here, which will tell you a little bit about the command center. In our operation, we're unloading stuff off of the water in Valdez, in Whittier, in Seward, in Anchorage. Some of it's moving by rail, some by truck, some by train to get into the warehouse location. To give you an idea of what's going to have to move to the warehouses that I'm going to show you here, it's roughly 1,700 container loads of about 13 tons each. That's about 22,000 tons, 44 million pounds of stuff that we're moving. Most of it moving through Valdez, but some scattered through all of those. Now, for that part that comes in over the water, there is a small piece that's in here. Don't be fooled by this big yellow square right here. There's a small dock facility that's there that has a small warehousing facility that we will use just as a transfer facility. And from that facility, we can move by rail or truck to what we call a laydown yard, which has 35 acres. That's just on the other side of O'Malley Road right here. That 35 acres has a small warehouse facility on it for something that you can do on the site, but it is very small. And our main warehouse is over here at the airport at a unit called the Troy Hangar. You may have seen the Troy Hangar at the airport. That provides us a very large facility there where we can do work on major equipment within that facility and provide storage, and there are about 8 acres at that site. So by train or truck, we will essentially bring in all of these 1,700 container loads into this spot right here. They in turn will be shuffled here. This is about 9 miles from here to here, about 7 miles from here to here, and something like 4 miles across there. And we'll be doing some shuffling, because what we're going to do is those of us that are here, and I'm one of them, are going to look in all of those containers this winter. This little pointer that I'm using is a key to the container exercise, by the way. I don't know if you've ever seen one of these. These are a serialized lock. And I haven't closed it up, because once you close it, it doesn't open anymore. It takes a bolt cutter to open that.
But essentially, every container, when it moves out, be it on a barge or on a train or on a truck, the doors will be bolted with this. This gives us a serial number by which we know what's in the material. All the material will be barcoded, and it allows us to run an intelligent inventory transportation system while we're working that. It turns out that's a much easier system to operate than locks. You don't have to worry about combinations and keys and all this kind of thing. You just carry a bolt cutter around. And once you use that, you throw it away, but they're only $2.50 a piece, and they're tough. They're tough. So this gives you a feel. Our office is at the Cal A2 building here off of C Street, and that's where we'll house the bulk of our some 300 or so people. We'll have people out here, obviously, that are housed, officed, if you will, at this warehouse facility that are directly involved in repairing inventory. For what I'll be doing, I'll maintain an office here and over here in between those two places because we'll be spending a lot of time at both of them. But that's what we tend to do. Now, your question was, when do I use that, right? Today. The first five of those 1,700 container loads are on the way. Whoops, they're on the way to here. Okay, so we're in process of beginning to move surplus material that's not needed for continued operation out of the yard right now. When will people move up into that office space? We actually have a few people in Anchorage already. We have some auditors in Anchorage. We have some invoice accounts payable people that are in Anchorage. Some of them are already there. And the rest of us will go as the operation dictates. It's more logical to be at this location than it is to be here in Valdez or Kodiak or wherever that is. So that it will be a phased operation that occurs probably about October the 1st. You know, some will go earlier, some will go later. Today. How long does it take a truck on Anchorage? 6 hours? 8 hours? Assuming they drive the speed limit? I'm sure our drivers would drive the speed limit. They're going to this laydown yard over here. We're actually, give you, it's a little detail, of that 35 acres, 5 acres is fenced and lighted. So the first units will go into that. We're actually going to grade and pave the remaining of the area and get a fence up, and that'll take a few days. So the area is totally not ready, but the first 5 acres are. That's where those first containers are going. Should be unloaded today. Oh, we've got all kinds of equipment in there that's not needed. If you've been out in our container yard, you see that there are some kinds of boom that we no longer need. You see there's a yard full of anchor chain, building materials, all sorts of support things. If you remember, to support this operation, we had to bring in winches, cables, anchor handling equipment, anchors, anchor chain, and that's a lot of what's in that yard out there that provides you the infrastructure to keep that fleet working out there. Now, we've got our fleet running. We know about what it takes to maintain it. That's surplus to what it takes to run this year, but I'm reluctant to turn it loose. I want to keep my hands on it. So I'm going to put it over here where we've got it under control, so it'll be in Alaska, so that we'll be able to take advantage of it. We'll have a lot more of that same stuff coming off the water when it comes back in. Yes, sir.
Do you anticipate ever having a big yard sale in a year or two? Give us some business, serious interest express, for example, inflatable skiffs to study
activity. Haven't worked that far. There are a few things. Now, that's, you know, they're always yes and no's to answer. And for things that are directly involved with the spill cleanup, and I'm talking about a skimmer or boom or Zodiacs or outboard motors, we haven't worked that problem. There are a few things that we probably do want to. Friend, let me give you an example. In the gymnasium where we've been housing some of the people that we brought in to help support local employment, we've got bunk beds. Okay, when we get through with that, those are surplus, and we'll probably have a yard sale or gymnasium sale or whatever you call that on bunk beds, because I think we've got more than enough of those. But I think they'll be in that category, nothing that's really related to things you put on the water.
I
There's a rumor that that the platelet skips are going to be destroyed.
I sure hope not. I hope that's just a rumor that nothing happens to it. I'm not planning on destroying anything. I don't imagine why we'd want to destroy anything.
Are you going to be keeping enough equipment so that if you decide that next year what are you going to be doing? Are you taking apart like these obby barges and maybe completely disassemble the equipment sent back south, or what will happen on that stuff?
If you will, let me get to that in a minute. I'm going to address some more detail on that, and I'll come to you what we're doing with those. But essentially, we're going to disassemble all of that stuff that's been put together. But the key oil recovery equipment will be located in these warehousing facilities. Okay? That kind of gives you an idea of what we're talking about for facilities and response and our organization capability. Now I want to move over and use a couple of simplified charts to talk about our science program. What we're interested in, of course, is what happens to this shoreline. And through the winter, we'll have an extensive science program that will be looking hard at this upper intertidal zone, and this is where the main oil impact was. But we'll also be looking at the lower intertidal zone. Al Mackey, who's here in the room, is running for the world's first and only study on looking at kelp and eelgrass for these kind of impacts. We're going to be looking, of course, at things that are the critters, if you will, that live here, such as the crab and the shrimp. We'll be taking sediment samples because, of course, there's another biological community that's involved with those, and we'll be looking specifically at the key fish that are in the area. Water quality will be measured. In addition, we plan to stand, if possible, with experts on the key beaches every 2 weeks during the wintertime. That's obviously going to be a weather-driven thing, and it may be weather-driven from two aspects. Sometimes we may want to stand on it right after a severe storm so that we can get a measurement of what happened at that particular time. But our target is to be there once every 2 weeks. We're going to take all of this data. It will be combined into a mapping program so that we can understand this on a geographical basis as well as site-specific basis. We'll also be doing studies that are not included here, such as wildlife surveys. That program involves about 12,000 samples and key observations taken during the wintertime. It is a massive, significant program. It is the link for us to understand, along with some related studies like some crude aging studies and some drift studies in the Cook Inlet, to understand what we can realistically expect to find here next spring. So this is a very important program. It's important that we run it well, that we get good, high-quality information, and that we do it safely. And it takes all that combination of equipment that we showed you that provides some response capability to also be able to put people safely on the shoreline. Essentially, you've got to put them on the shoreline or near the shoreline during the winter months. Now, it's not just as simple as saying, I want to go out in December and measure something. Now, what our guys have also taken a look at, and this chart just gives you an idea of it, they also want to be there when the tide is low, if you're looking at these, in daylight. Okay? That means that as the days get shorter, there are some days you can't go because you won't have any low tide, meaningful low tide during the daylight hours. So consequently, we've gone through for the various studies and on a month-by-month basis laid out where the window of opportunity to gather the information that you want. So that's a combination of tide, light, and what is the study that you're running? Because different studies are looking at different things. Obviously, some of them can be combined. Where we can combine data gathering, we will, and put that together. You know, if a guy is here gathering a water sample, he might be able to do a grab sediment sample, and we'll combine those kind of efforts. And some of that is reflected in this chart. But just to give you an example of how that impacts on you, you just get an idea. If you look at November, there's a lot of windows in November. While the days are a little shorter in December, we get caught with that tide cycle, and you just see there are less windows of opportunity
to do some of that work in December while it picks up again in January. Now, the guys have to work that problem as they go through. And you see we have some things that run through other cycles and some things that are continuous that are going on. So it's an extensive program. It's a well-planned program. 12,000 different samples to get analyzed over the wintertime is a lot of lab work. You guys have been in contact with lab work. That is a lot of work to get done. And it's a lot of work to analyze and understand. Those two things are the, and you've got more detail in your package on what these programs are. You've got more detail in your package on what the community liaison effort is that ties into these things. And you've got some information in your package on a recommendation that we've made to the U.S. Coast Guard and ADEC. By the way, just before this review with you, we had the Coast Guard in, and we had ADEC in, and we gave them the same review we're giving you. And in that, we gave them a recommendation that through the winter, we continue to meet with these various committees. And we have a steering committee, and we have a research and an R&D committee. We have a science committee. We have a shoreline committee. We have MAC committees in some of the communities. We have suggested dates for each of these committees to meet during the wintertime, and suggested that in March, as we begin to really draw into the spring, that we really step up that meeting pace on an as-needed basis so that we do that. We have offered so that we can facilitate those better, to hold those in Anchorage, but we're flexible on where they are, and we'll wait on the Coast Guard to respond on how they propose to do that. We would like to see that communication process continue through the winter.
How much scientific staffing are you going to have at each of the communities in the Arctic?
Now, most of the scientific people, there'll be exceptions to that. Most of them will be in Anchorage, and we'll use that as our aircraft center, if you will. Now, there are always exceptions. Some will be on boats some of the time. We're in our contingency plan, we're going to have some emergency housing at Chenega. Some of them may spend a night or two at Chenega some of the time. Some of them are going to be in the towns or villages that are close to the site that they're working some of the time, because it's a field program. A lot, you got to be out in the field to do that stuff, and we're concerned about that. For that kind of purpose, when we send out one Beaver as a float plane to do something, I'll just tell you now, we're going to send two, so that we don't have good search and rescue capability if the weather goes bad. And I want to be sure that we've got a way of taking care of people if somebody has a mechanical problem in severe weather conditions. So we'll be running that kind of backup capability for those people.
Sounds like you're not going to get too much work use out of your new building that you just moved into over there.
Well, there'll be some people here through the winter, Charles. There'll be some claims people. There'll be some of our invoicing people, community liaison. Some of our key operations people will stay in here until November the 1st. And as some of you have heard me say before, I don't know what will happen in the spring. But it is a facility if we need it. You'll be ready if we need it. And yes, I would have liked to have had it ready to use right here a month earlier than we did.
Mr.
Yes, sir.
In light of your offer earlier, I'm really interested in the uptake of hydrocarbons by Caltrans. And I have been talking to Al Mackey for a number of months about that study. I thought I saw a slight smile when you mentioned it, but there's really nothing to smile about. There's a deep scientific purpose, and no one has really looked at this as a wonderful opportunity for a botanist to get at this. The question I have, though, is do I have your assurances that as the data is produced, that is, as the findings come out of this, it's going to be made available to the public? NOAA, for example, is already being made available to me. The early results of the Night Island trawling of benthic life. I'm just going to analyze the primary carbon effect on the biology. Just as it may, the early results are not supposed to be published until the fall. They're making it available to me, and I'm sure other journalists who have. I made the same request to
Well, first, let me assure you, one of our 26 key studies, we don't take any of them lightly. We have top quality people on those studies. We have an intensive scientific program behind every one of those studies, and none of those are taken lightly. The eelgrass and kelp is a unique study. We think it's important or we wouldn't be in it. We think that study is important. I think you will find that Al Mackey has released all of his data to the public as it's become available, and I don't know of exception to that. Well, I would disagree with you. I would say this is not the format to talk about it, and Al's sitting right behind you, and why don't you talk to him after the end of this? We're glad to have you talk to him.
When you said that people will be standing on key beaches during the wintertime, what key beaches?
Well, let me pick Smith Island, okay? Well-known place. Smith Island, we would like to have experts, shoreline cleanup experts, on Smith Island every 2 weeks to study what the condition of the beaches are. Now, that's in addition to our biological surveys that we're running and our water analysis, but we want people who understand shoreline cleanup and oil in rock conditions to be there so that we get a valid scientific observation and measurements where appropriate of what is the condition of those severely impacted shorelines. But those are the kind of shorelines. They are identified. We have a science program. Those are identified. All of those are available. We'll be glad to make that information available to you.
The state has asked for some kind of a strike force
Well, in the contingency plan that I just showed you before, you'll notice that those boats, one of those in Valdez has skimming capability, you'll find in your write-up, are the kind of boats that can get out on seas in rough weather. Now, you're only going to be able to realistically skim in calm weather, but you can only send out boats that are prepared for rough weather. So we're going to have a boat that's capable. We will have boats, not a boat. We will have boats that are capable of putting out snare boom, which is about the only thing you can do any good with sheen on, if you can do any good at all. Sheen being non-toxic to start with, but it may be an appropriate thing to do. If you have something heavier, we do have the capability of throwing a skimmer over the side of one of those boats, so that we'd be able to conduct some skimming operations. It's kind of a what-if question. What do you find out there? What we can describe to you are what the capabilities are, that we have forces available that would be able to get out and do that. Whether weather would allow you to get there is another question.
Will these be people that will be on your payroll and ready to go, or will these be people who will be at home going about their business and have to come to some kind of center?
It's a combination of both. The boats will be manned 24 hours a day, fully manned, ready to steam. That's at all locations. All winter, okay? The boats are always ready to steam. In some cases, the appropriate thing, depending on where the boat is, it may have been out for an observation, and then the appropriate thing may be to get people out there via a float plane to the boat, or, you know, you've got to look at what the conditions are and where the equipment is when the emergency arises. But yes, the boats will be manned and ready. Now, let's just say you want a team of 20 people, pick a number out of the air, and you want a team of 20 people to do something that neither you nor I anticipate. You just now know you want 20 people for it. We will have a call-up list available that allows us to call on 20 experienced people through our contractor that we would be able to get out on a call-out notice, so that we could immediately dispatch them along with whatever equipment was available to that emergency. And we'll keep that call-up list in each of the key communities as I indicated earlier. Well, I think there are two pieces of the hatchery protection. If y'all will allow me to digress on that in just a moment. One of those is if you had oil on the water that you thought might be going in that direction, one piece of it is to try to collect it or skim it up before it got there. And that's what the boats and the snare boom and these kind of things allow you to do. The second piece is to have some booming capability directly at the hatcheries. And what we're describing in that kind of case, and you saw it on the box, is that we would like to make arrangements with the villages such as Chinega and Tetitlik, so that on site we would have stored on those sites boom and protective clothing and whatever is necessary for that, so that if something happened and they could get the snare boom out on that location, we had arrangements to do that. We have not made those arrangements. They may or may not be willing to do that. We think they probably will, but I can't speak for them, and we've got to go out and make those. I think we can make some sort of arrangement that will give us something that approximates that capacity. Whether with a private contractor or whether directly with the village. Does that answer what you mean? Okay. Yes. Whoops. Yes. A lot of questions, so let me start at the back end of that and see if I can answer that for you. We expect to have the waste management program complete by about the end of October, and that includes solid waste and liquid waste. That's our plan, and of course that, like other things, has some weather dependency in it. One piece of getting into that position is firing up the two incinerators, and one of the incinerators is down at Kodiak, and of course one is here in Prince William Sound, and we hope to fire the one in Prince William Sound by about Tuesday. We had to add some burner capability to that unit. And the one at Kodiak, at the request of Admiral Cangolini, we postponed the startup for a day to see if there can be some resolution on a site, or a better resolution on a site down there. So if not, then we would start at the current site probably about 5:30 today. As you know, when we say start, these are units that have to heat up to quite high degrees, so you turn it on and it takes a little while for the unit to get up and to be stable, but in effect fire it up and get the process going. They will only operate probably through about the first week in September. They are